My name is Sharon, and I serve the village as education lead. And again, a full house. We've been having full houses almost every session all summer, so that is wonderful. Thank you for coming. We have our speaker mic'd up, so you should be able to hear him. If you're asking questions or comments, if you could use your playground voice, that helps a whole lot. So think back when you were able to do that quickly. So it's my pleasure to introduce Roy Hammerly, Professor of Religion at Concordia College Moorhead, because there are more than one, Moorhead, Minnesota, let's be clear on that. Roy has been has taught at Pullman several years, and we're so pleased to have him back on the Wittenberg door, 500 years of reform. Thank you, Roy.
Thank you, Sharon. I just try to figure out the sound. Is that about right there? Well, thanks. I'll let experts figure out what to do. Okay. Well, thanks to Holden, Chuck, and Peg, and everyone that's invited me to be here. It's always great to be back in the Pacific Northwest. I grew up not too far from here, but moved away and haven't got back. I'm living out in the Midwest. And last year when I was here, I was talking with Chuck and Peg, and we were talking about the idea of doing something, if I came back, doing something with the 500th anniversary of the 95 Theses. And so I came up with the idea of doing, the idea of thinking about Martin Luther as a reformer. But as I was starting to think about what I would talk about and what I would present, I was really curious about the idea of how Luther formed his conscience, right? How does a person go from being a young kid in a small town in Mansfield, Germany, to becoming somebody who changed history very radically in the time of the 16th century, and who was a pretty ordinary sort of human being? And I came up with this idea of trying to figure out how Luther's conscience developed and how that might help us, if we think about looking at one individual like Luther, how that might help us think about how do we develop our own conscience and move ourselves to convictions and values and being a person who makes a difference in the world. And so as I started doing some of this research, I realized that not many people had done it. And part of the reason is that Luther himself is a bit of a problem historically for historians. I'm a medievalist. I went to the University of Notre Dame. I studied medieval history and Reformation history. And I soon came to realize, come on in, don't be embarrassed at all. Not everybody isn't looking at you right at this moment. You're more than welcome. But I realized that most of how historians have looked at Luther is they've kind of taken him at his word about what he says about himself. And that's a bit of a problem, because Luther doesn't tell us much about his life until he gets very old. And when you get older, you kind of remember things in a different way. And I was trying to figure out, did Luther think a certain way at a particular time? Did this move him to be a person of conviction? And he always talks about himself in retrospect. In fact, the best piece of writing that we have about him telling us anything about his life is in his preface to his Latin writings. A very exciting piece of writing, as you can imagine. Just something people pick off the shelf. The preface to his Latin writings, in which he kind of goes on this tangent and he talks about his life and his early life and how he came to be. But it's clear, even in that piece, he's not really sure how he got to be who he was. And so what I'd like to do is explore a little of that today. And I'm going to do that in actually three sessions here at Holden. I can't get through the whole timeline of Luther's development of his conscience in one of these lectures. So what I'm going to do is find a way to develop that over three lectures. And if you just come to this one, hopefully you'll get something out of it. You go to the next one, but I'm going to talk more about the 95 Theses, give a background to that and why that piece is so important in Luther's development of his conscience. And then ultimately, in the third lecture, I'm going to talk about the Diet of Worms, where Luther really develops his idea of conscience and says to the emperor and to the imperial lords of Europe, I'm not going to recant my writings, and I can't because of my conscience. And that's a pretty remarkable statement, and a pretty remarkable moment in history. And so I would like to have, but it's going to take us a while to get there. And so what my method was is I went back and I looked at writings of Luther's that aren't very accessible to most people. They're mostly in Latin, a little bit in Old German, and they're like Luther's early lectures. And I had to kind of go back and look through those texts and see if he threw out little gems, hopefully, to help me figure out what he was about. But I'd like to start 1 year after the 95 Theses, and the year is 1518, when an ambassador from Venice decides to write a letter to the Holy Roman Emperor Maximilian I. This is Maximilian. Pretty imposing looking guy, isn't he? That's a pretty impressive work. When you have Albrecht Dürer doing your portrait, you think things are going pretty well. Now, so this ambassador writes a letter to Maximilian I, and he's very upset because there's a diet, and a diet is the emperor calls all the lords in the Holy Roman Empire, and you can see some of the Holy Roman Empire, how it's divided up here, and here's Venice down here. So the Venetian ambassador writes to the Holy Roman Emperor and says, we've got a problem. What the hell are you doing at the Diet of Augsburg? You are spending a lot of time being, quote, distracted from reality because you're talking about a little monk from Wittenberg and his challenge to the idea of indulgences. It's a very interesting letter. And what is the reality that this ambassador is worried about? He is afraid of the Ottoman Empire. Because you can see that Suleiman the Magnificent and others who are a part of the Ottoman Empire have pushed this empire nearly to Venice. And they are going to get all the way up to Vienna. And he says, we have real problems. We have the problem of this advancing Muslim army, and we need to solve this problem, and I need money, and you're talking about a German monk and indulgences. Why are you being distracted from reality? And so as a result, Maximilian says what the ambassador wants is a penny tax, a crusader tax. It's called the Turkish penny. He wants a Turkish penny on every household throughout the Holy Roman Empire to fund a war to stop Muslim advances in the East. And that's reality. Now, I find it really fascinating. I'm going to take moments where I'll stop and kind of stop thinking about the historical piece and think about the modern world. And I'm so struck that this fear of Islam is something that hasn't gone away, right?
Yeah.
We're still dealing with this sort of issue. But in any case, this fear that this ambassador writes, and he says, so he decides, Maximilian is somewhat supportive of the ambassador. There's the papal states, which are down here, are also a threat to the Venetians. And so they're trying to work out an agreement which will make sure that the Venetian states are secure. And so Maximilian agrees to this penny tax, and they decide that they will support the war effort against the Muslims, and they bring this to the table at the Diet of Worms. And there happens to be a guy by the name of Frederick, and he gets the moniker Wise. I'll tell you a little bit later in a later lecture, because he's a pretty astute and clever guy and a very important supporter of Luther's, by the way, and because Luther is a monk in his lands. But Frederick of Saxony and Frederick the Wise and other lords from Germany feel like they're being overtaxed And they're not convinced that this penny tax, this Turkish penny, is something that they should be paying, because they're already taxed to a great degree. And the German contingent at the Diet is very, very frustrated with Maximilian imposing just another tax upon the groups of people. And then they said, okay, so Maximilian knows now that they're spending a lot of time talking about the idea of indulgences. The papal states are imposing indulgences throughout the empire. And it's a very complicated issue, but I'll get into that next time. And so they're imposing they're offering these indulgences, which people are paying, and now they're offering another tax. And along comes this guy who's a problem. How did Luther, as a kid, as an adult, become a problem? How did he become a question? The question I want to ask is, how does he become a distraction from reality? And so in order to do that, I want to talk about a few points just today. We're only going to get down to Luther and the time of him becoming a professor. The first thing I want to talk about is his childhood, which is rather very normal. He has a life-changing event in his life, which kind of develops this awakening in Luther, kind of a passion in his conscience. We're going to talk a little bit about passion and conscience today, but I'm going to hold off some of those broader ideas until the later lectures. And this idea that Luther at one point says there's a niggling question that comes to him and that he wants to try to answer. And it's interesting to me that this idea of a niggling question becomes, I think, kind of the root of where Luther gets his conscience. Now, what is all that about? We'll get to it, okay? So how did Luther, this is a picture by Lucas Cranach in the 1520s. If you look at him, this skinny monk, how did he become a distraction from reality? Well, originally, Luther was, and by the way, I'm willing to stop anytime if you have questions. I'll leave some time at the end for questions for us to talk about. Some of you are from Minneapolis area. How many of you got to go see the exhibit? Pretty amazing exhibit, right? Those of you who didn't go, there was an exhibit of Luther artifacts from Europe that was there. And one of the things that's really interesting as you went into that exhibit, the very first part of it was a discussion about Luther's family and his background. And Luther himself, and I'm going to quote Luther here at this point, says that when he was growing up, that he was in the family, he was a part of a family of peasants in which his mother had to carry all the wood on her back and during hardships that the world today would no longer want to put up with. Luther talks about, and most people accept the reality that he grew up in a peasant family. In reality, he didn't. What's interesting is if the excavations at his hometown in Mansfeld, where he grew up, have recently gone through his old home and went through the garbage dump of the house, right? And they found that, for example, Luther and his family regularly ate suckling pigs. That was a delicacy in the Middle Ages, and it wasn't something that everybody had on the table. They also found, like, clasps of their clothing. There's a magnificent D clasp for a belt that his sister Dorothy wore. And as people were looking at their house, they said, this is the house of a wealthy family. And so how did Luther get this perception that he was from a poor family? Well, his family along the way was fairly, there wasn't too many classes in the Middle Ages until about the 13th century when we started having a merchant class. And then that merchant class was pretty wealthy itself. But eventually what happens is Luther's father, Hans, becomes a copper miner. He's very industrious, very bright, very intelligent man. And he is able to kind of eventually turn that opportunity into where he owns a fair amount of land. He works in the copper mines, but also owns the copper mines. And his mother, who had to carry those sticks on her back, Margareta. They were called Luders, Luder, L-U-D-E-R, but Luther changed the name later to Luther. It's a whole background to that. We won't go into that. But we find out that Luther thought of himself as poorer than he really was. And I started thinking about that, and I thought, you know, that's kind of how I describe myself, too. What I think, you know, my parents are German immigrants. They came to this country from Russia. They were refugees during the war. And, you know, things, they had a difficult life. But my dad was prosperous. He found out a way. He became a carpenter. He made his way in the world. And what my dad wanted for me as he made his way was that he wanted me to get an education. My dad only had a high school education. My mother had a grade school education. My dad didn't really even have a high school degree until he came to the United States and later took the GED exam so that he could get a job. But his main goal for me was that he wanted me to be educated. And that's what Luther's father wanted for him as well, and his mother. Because they had, now there was 8 kids in the family, but because they had wealth, they could afford to send Luther off to school. And so, what do we know about Luther so far? Well, all I would say is, he's just a normal kid, right? There's nothing really extraordinary here. I was kind of mining this background, trying to figure out if I could find something in Luther that very early on kind of pricked him as a kid, as a conscience. I can't find it. He's just a normal kid. What he does get from his parents is a will to learn and an industriousness. He was a hard-working kid. In fact, when we see writings, other writings, it seems that he was very timid, which is not the Luther we get to know later, right? He was a very timid kid in the schools. And part of that was because, well, you know, schools were tough in those days. Luther talks about being beaten regularly. He calls school hell, his purgatory, his prison. And there's a beautiful little piece of literature. I mean, in those days, they often talked about, you know, this whole spare the rod, spoil the child. Luther writes, "The best thing I ever received from my father was the possession of an education. It taught me that life could be joyful." And then Luther goes on to say, "We should not be too harsh on our children when we teach them as they're growing up. We should encourage them with joyful play." Whoops, let me go too far. Encourage them with joyful play. And I love that idea. Luther, in a time where education was all about, you know, learning certain things in a certain way and with the rod and you learn it or else sort of thing. Luther says he believes that education is best done in another way. I'm not sure there's any one of us in the room that probably doesn't agree with that. But how many of you would say that you had harsh educations? And for example, I was paddled in my grade school a number of times. Did anybody else have corporal punishment? Just all the professors in the, no. there's a few of us, right? And they slowly got away with that. I don't know, you know, there was laws, I guess, that they created to protect children. But it's interesting that Luther really feels that education was really kind of his key to finding his life. But Luther basically did what his parents wanted him to do, and that was to go to school. For Luther, that really meant going to law school. His dad said, "Become a lawyer. That's the most lucrative sort of position you can have. It's the road to becoming a statesman if you want to become a congressperson. Whatever you want to do, this is the way, your path to securities, financial security." And Luther's other brothers and sisters had similar opportunities in education that other people weren't quite afforded during this time. And so Luther goes off to school. And one of the things that he learns is the 7 liberal arts. The liberal arts at that time were rather narrow in focus. You have basically grammar, rhetoric, and logic under the trivium, and then math, geometry, and astronomy, and music A lot of people are puzzled why music is in with this, but it was considered, you know, mathematical, right? Octaves and fifths and fourths and those sorts of things. So music was under the quadrivium. And they studied the Middle Ages, liberal arts rather broadly. And Luther loved the liberal arts. And this quote from Ovid, I think, is one that I find why the liberal arts are so important. Ovid, who lives around the time of Christ, once wrote that a faithful study of the liberal arts humanizes character and permits it not to be cruel. That there's something about education that allows us the opportunity to examine our lives in a way that opens our eyes to ourselves. It opens our eyes to our society around us. It opens us, hopefully, our eyes to the idea of not being cruel, as Ovid says. And for Luther, that was also the case. He does talk about the idea that the liberal arts gave him the ability to think creatively and to ask important questions about society and the world that he was living in. And as a result, he kind of moves on. Now, I'm just really curious about one thing at this point. How many of you started out in college following your parents' advice, doing the thing that they wanted you to do? Now, start it up. No, wow, that's a small group. Did everybody else have your own view? Your parents didn't have any idea that you should go in this?
Or we were clueless.
Or you were clueless or you didn't know?
Yeah.
It's really interesting. I really resonate with Luther at this point. My dad wanted me to be an architect. And I got to college, and I immediately started taking philosophy classes. I thought, oh, philosophy, you can think. And my dad said, you should be an architect. I said, Dad, if I built a mall, it would collapse and kill people. You don't want me to do that. But my dad never really got over the fact that I went off and became a pastor. And because when I told him, I'm going to go to the ministry, Dad. What do you think of that? And he said, you can't make money doing that. My dad grew up in an area not far from where Luther lived, so I always felt, was that just the regional thing, or I don't know. But I have a feeling that there's, you know, the parents put pressure on us to do things, but usually the pressure is to do something that they think will make you comfortable, right? I'm not sure if that's true for everybody. I'm a little surprised at that. Well, Luther grew up in this family, which is well-to-do, normal family. He studies the liberal arts. It starts to awaken something in him. But he's studying law. He's still pursuing his family's goal and love for him. And what we know from his early writings about him, there seems to be two things that come through in this thing. And I'm going to use this illustrative story to illustrate this. Luther, when he was in law school, had a sword. You know, that also suggests a certain amount of wealth, right? Not everybody had swords. But Luther had a sword, and one day he had an accident with that sword in which he cut the femoral artery in his thigh. It was an accident. It sounds like he was just trying to sheathe the sword and missed the sheath and went into his leg. And he nearly dies in this. And later on, when he recalls this incident, he said, all I can say is I was saved by the prayers to the Blessed Virgin and thanks to my good doctor. Right? Notice that comment. It's really interesting because what we see in it, Luther, first of all, suggests that one of the things that he's really interested in is he's a devout person, right? His family is religious, although what we learn from his father is he doesn't trust them priests. Because, you know, those priests just can't be trusted. All they really want is money, more money for Rome or for the church or for that sort of thing. And so his father is very skeptical of organized religion, although devout in his own sort of way. His mother seems to have been more devout, and Luther talks about her kind of devotion to the saints and to God as being kind of the main place that he gets his religious convictions, was really from his mother. His father is not so much. Well, so one day, you all know this story. It's such an iconic story. It's taken on such a legendary quality to it. Luther is on a road in Germany. He's going back to law school. He's been home to visit his parents. He's going back to law school, and a thunderstorm breaks out. And this is that one point. So we have the normal childhood. We have this kind of this education. Now we have this life-changing event. He's riding along on a horse, and going back to law school, again, a horse suggests wealth that most people don't have in this day. And the lightning knocks him off his horse. He's in a field. The lightning bolts are flashing all around him. And Luther makes a very rash vow. He says, "Saint Anne, Saint Anne, save me. I'll become a monk." Now, who is Saint Anne? Saint Anne is the mother of the Virgin Mary. She is the patron saint of those people who are in trouble. And so she's the right saint to call out to. You know, if you're in trouble, you ever need anything, St. Anne's the one you want to talk to. And Luther calls out to her and says, "St. Anne, St. Anne, save me." This is in early July, July 2nd of 1505. In 2 weeks, Luther will wind up at the door of the Augustinian monastery in Erfurt, Germany, knocking on the door and asking entrance. Anybody want to guess who this monastery is dedicated to? St. Anne. It's the Augustinian Monastery of St. Anne. And it makes all the sense in the world that he would go to the Augustinians. But he also says to us that not only does he go there because of his rash vow, he goes there because the Augustinian order is very dedicated to education, and their priests and they're really called friars. They're not really monks. So he hedged on that. Make me a monk. I'll become a friar. Okay, a friar. St. Anne, St. Anne's monastery. I'll become a friar. 2 weeks later, he joins the monastery. It's a very rash thing to do. His father is livid. He's throwing he's got this great education. He's on his way to becoming a lawyer. Everything is going right. And now he goes into the monastery. And his father, remember, he hated those priests. You know, he was joining the it's like going over to the dark side, right? You know, for Luther's father. And so what we find is that Luther, as he joins the monastery, he decides that he will continue this route. Within 2 years, this scene is a replica. I'm mixing cartoons that are on the web. There's actually a cartoon that's only in German on the Lutheran World Federation site about Luther's life, and this is it goes through his whole life. This is Luther, the boy, going into the monastery as a friar, and because of this life-changing event, he decides that he will now start looking into a different goal. Now, think of it. It's 1502. I'm a historian. I like dates, right? And I won't ask any questions of you at all at the end. But it's 1502. He goes into 1505. Excuse me. Goes into the monastery on July 17th. 2 weeks after he has this storm. 2 years later, he will become a priest. That's pretty record time in those days. But he's going to become a priest in the Augustinian order. And then, also in record time, 5 years later, in 1512, he will earn a doctorate in biblical theology, especially Old Testament. And that's 1512. For the next 5 years, he's going to be a professor and do studying. He's going to be teaching biblical studies, largely theology and biblical studies, for the next 5 years. And during that time, that's if you think about it, from 1505 to 1517, that's 12 years. And 1517 is, this year, on October 31st, 2017, is the 500th anniversary of Luther's 95 Theses. That day, it took him 12 years to get to the 95 Theses. We tend to think, in the mythology of Luther, that when we hear the story about Luther, that he becomes a monk and a couple days later he's just pissed off and he just goes nail something on the door, right? That's kind of what our image is. But there's this long process by which Luther comes to this decision and makes something happen. Now, He begins to go off his studies to become a priest, awaken something in him. He is now, when he talks about his education, as opposed to what he was doing in law school, now has a certain fire within him burning. There's this passion that is starting to develop. There's something awakening in his soul that he couldn't foresee. Had he pursued law, it may never have happened. Now, I should say that Luther, I want to make it read to you a few lines from Luther about his decision. He was talking to his friend Melanchthon one day, and this was written down about the conversation. He says, "Why did I take that rash vow? I am uncertain. I don't even know what attitude I took that vow under. I was, I guess, more overpowered than drawn by something within me. It just seemed like at that moment God wanted me to do something. I am afraid that I took the vow in an impious and a sacrilegious way." And what he means by that is he only took the vow to save his own skin. It's not the right reason for taking a vow, says Luther, right? Save me and then I'll do something. No, you should take a vow because it's the right thing to do. You should take a vow because something has moved you to that. And he knows that he hasn't done it for the right reasons. And he's confessing this to his dearest friends. Well, so he starts having this awakening within himself. And I would say the awakening is of twofold. One, it's this new passion he has for study that he wouldn't have had if he'd gone into law school. And secondly, it seems to be the beginnings of a conscience. And it's hard to kind of tease out, but I think it's there. Now, in order to talk about passion and conscience, I'm going to take an excursus for a minute, and I'm going to use some other people as examples. Is it warm in here, or is it just because I'm living in here? The fact that you're awake at this point is what?
If someone would open that door, that sometimes helps.
Maybe it gets a little older. I'm amazed that you're awake because I'm both a pastor and a teacher and I have a double somniac effect on people. I can put people to sleep. Just ask my students. You can still see that okay? So it seems to me that there's two key elements. One is this idea that there's a sort of passion that develops within Luther and that moves him to some sort of conscience. So what is passion? You can't really see Mark Twain here, but this is a quote from Mark Twain. He says, "The two most important days in your life are the day that you are born and then the day that you find out why." And for Luther, the day he found out why was when he began to immerse himself in biblical study. There was something in it that awakened in him who he was. So passion, I think, develops out of two things. It seems to develop out of both the talent an individual has, but also the interest. And I have known students that have had no talent in an area, but have gone to pursue it anyway, just because they have the interest. And I have known people who have interests and talents and have mixed the two. Or you might have one or the other. But it's in this case, Luther clearly had talent. He was a very gifted, intelligent person. His passion became biblical studies, and it became a driving force in his life. He just threw himself into it. And when I read those early lectures, there seems to be two things that he's passionate about. One, that the scriptures seem to be unfolding a way for him to see the world that makes sense, and that also moves him to kind of an undeniable sense of how the world should be. Now, this is very early on, and what he means, what he gets from this, I think, is kind of this idea that his passion is pushing him along, but it's helping him understand the world. I'm going to use some other examples of people throughout history that I have made some really interesting comments. Florence Nightingale, you may not know much about her life. She was a very wealthy young aristocrat in England. She was all set to marry one of the brightest and best of the socialite society in England. Her family, whether if the marriage wasn't completely arranged, it was certainly highly approved of. Everything she had, everything she could ever want. She goes to Germany, and she's starting to study as a nurse. And while she's in Germany, she meets up with a bunch of German pietists who are dedicated to taking care of the poor and the hungry and the needy and taking care of their needs. And she says at that time, God spoke to me and called me to service. What form this service would take, I cannot say. She didn't know. There was at the moment that she has this experience like Luther. It's like a lightning bolt, except Luther's is so iconic, right? It is a lightning bolt. It nearly kills him. I was in Germany. My parents, my grandparents lived in Germany. I remember being out with my grandparents, and we got caught in a thunderstorm. And I got why Luther made that vow. I mean, it was scary. I mean, they're a really powerful story. But sometimes the lightning bolt comes in the form of seeing something. And for Florence Nightingale, it was seeing the needy and the poor, and she says, at that moment, I knew I had to do something, but I wasn't sure what it was. And then she goes on to be, well, the greatest nurse of all time. But it became her passion. Her passion and her talent pushed her into this direction. I always like this one. I'm neither clever nor especially gifted. I'm only very, very curious. And Einstein never really thought of himself as being all that intelligent. I've read a couple biographies about him. I find him a really interesting person. Very complicated. All these people are very complicated. I should say, by the way, Florence Nightingale never married. She gave up her husband and went off and, as you know, fought in the Crimean War, worked in the Crimean Wars in these terrible situations where she developed healthy nursing practices. She gave up the life that she really had that was in front of her. Einstein is very complicated and an interesting individual, but I think he kind of gets us along that same way. And two people that I really have admired over the years that I've liked reading with my students is Dorothy Day and Mother Teresa, and they both met at one point. They have really interesting life stories, and what I found was a kind of a pattern with Luther and these people is that they seem to have this calling, but they're not really sure what it's about. They just simply have to follow this passion. It's like suddenly they can't stop themselves. Dorothy Day, you may not know her story. She grew up in San Francisco, lived through the 1906 earthquake, has kind of a... her father was a journalist. She goes into a journalist career, starts writing, gets involved with another journalist. She is part of a bohemian crowd. She's really good friends with Eugene O'Neill, the playwright. While she's in this sort of crowd, she gets pregnant, she has an abortion, she kind of goes off, secludes herself, starts writing, and then one day comes along a nun, a Benedictine nun, who happens to be feeding the poor. She's living on Staten Island back when Staten Island wasn't what it is today. But when she's living on Staten Island, they're taking care of the poor and the needy, and she realizes that something's missing from her life. And suddenly within her is awakened a passion for the poor. And she can't get rid of it. And suddenly she realizes that her passion, she's a part of the Communist Party at this time. She's been arrested. She's been on a hunger strike for women's rights and voting rights, and she's been a part of the women's suffragette movement. And all that's important to her. It's key. But the passion that she had when she finds this sort of dedication that the Catholic Church had towards the poor and the needy, that was the key. It flipped her. And she starts pursuing that passion and her life. Mother Teresa, a young girl in Yugoslavia, very different lifestyle. I mean, these two couldn't be more different in their upbringing. So what is normal as a child's upbringing? I don't know. But she's very devout, very religious, decides she wants to be a nun at the age of 12, has to wait till she's, you know, a little older than that. They don't take girls at 12. And so she goes off and becomes a part of the Sisters of Loretto. And she has this deep call. And she even says, I had this call to follow God. I thought it meant to be a sister of Loretto, but I didn't know that there would be a call within the call. And that was to go to Calcutta and take care of the poorest of the poor. And she had to leave her religious order in order to do that because they wouldn't allow her to do that. They were an educational order. And caused a great deal of difficulty in her life, but her passion drives her to Calcutta. And she had a very strong voice early in her life telling her to be and serve other people. It's this passionate thing that's lying there, right? And if you've never read her beautiful book, which never should have been written, Come Be My Light, it's some of you are nodding, it's a fantastic, it's her letters of confession to her priest, and he was supposed to burn them, because, you know, they're letters of confession, right? And he was supposed to burn them at the end of her life, and he sent them to the Pope instead, and they decided to publish them. And what you find in this letter, in this book, is that Mother Teresa, after that, once she finds her passion, once she's with the poor and the needy, the voice of God goes away. And she enters in what she will call the dark night of the soul. And she says, all of a sudden she started questioning, is this the right thing to do? These are her letters to her confessor. Was this, did I take this rash vow? Sound like Luther, right? I take this rash vow, I go off, I never knew it would be this hard. But her passion wouldn't stop her from going the direction she was going. I use these examples in part because I think they're more modern and we can relate to them. But also I think the other thing is that there's something to me as I was reading and trying to figure out Luther, I think there's something in all of us, there's this passion that's deep down within us that we can't really control. We may not even have a talent for this thing, but it still somehow pushes us in a direction that we can't help ourselves. And then once you get in following that passion and you're pursuing it, and your conscience is even forcing you to there, you have tons of doubt along the way. And you're even towards the end of your life, you may not even make sure, you know, might not be sure that it was the right decision. Right? That's what these examples suggest to me. And for Luther, there's a little bit of that. I want to quickly just distinguish between passion and passions. Cahil Gibran has this real great quote, "The lust for comfort murders the passions of the soul." I think, notice that there's two passions in this quote. The passion that we have for the desires of this world, right? You know, things that make it easy, comfort, become a lawyer, right? When I talk to students at Concordia and they say, I'm going to be a doctor. And I say, that's great. Why do you want to be a doctor? Well, because I want to serve humanity, but I also want to afford a lifestyle that I would like. And it's in that quick succession of, I don't know which one is which, right? Which is your real passion? You can do that, right? You serve humanity, but are you going into the job for what reason? Is it your passion? And that's where I start asking students, is this your passion? Are you going into it because you really want to help people in this particular way? You have a talent this way? Or what is it? And that's sometimes a complicating question. So there are these passions that are drive us to the things, to our best selves, but there are also passions, and unfortunately the same word can be used and put, that drive us in the wrong way, right? So I just wanted you to note that there's a complication here. So what about conscience for a minute? Well, conscience, Luther talks about when he's studying the liberal arts, that it helps him not to be cruel, right? That Ovid quote, that a true pursuit of the liberal arts helps you not to be cruel. I have to just make a quick side point. The liberal arts, the word the liberal arts came from originally started in Greece. The reason it was called liberal arts is because liberal means free, and there was only a small segment of that society that was free enough to study the arts, and that was the rich. So the liberal arts really starts out as a very privileged opportunity. And by the way, I reiterate this with all my students. You are in this room because you're privileged, right? You have the opportunity to get a liberal arts education because you're privileged. You have the freedom to get this, but there's a lot of people out there that don't have that freedom. And we have to figure out how to come to grips with that. But with study, conscience helps us develop a sense of justice. There comes a time when a moral man, says Martin Luther King Jr., can't obey a law which his conscience tells him is unjust. Or cowardice asks us the question, is it safe? Expedience asks the question, is it politic? Vanity asks the question, is it popular? But conscience asks the question, is it right? And there comes a time when one must take a position that is neither safe nor political nor popular, but one must take it because it is right. I can't help but think that something underneath Luther's drive in this vow, rash as it was, for the wrong reason that he made it, it just felt like for him, in his description of it, he says it was just the right thing to do. It was the only thing that I could do, even though I don't understand it, and it was probably a really stupid thing to say. Helen Keller, just to add to this, says the highest result of education is tolerance. Long ago, men fought and died for their faith, but it took ages to teach them the other kind of courage, the courage to recognize faiths of their brethren and their rights of conscience. Luther's moving to a right of conscience against the state. He is a distraction from reality. Passions move us to start to understand the world around us, the culture around us. And conscience moves us to this idea of asking, does it have to be this way? Eleanor Roosevelt said, when will our consciences grow so tender that we will act to prevent human misery rather than avenge it? Well, I have to just point out something about Luther that happened to him as he got into his passions. And so Luther's throwing himself into his studies. He loves this. He's deeply committed to it. It's awakening something in him that's both his passion and his conscience. But there's also something, and you can't really see the word because it's kind of white here, but Luther has what in the Germans called an Anfechtung, or the plural is Anfechtungen, which means you can't really translate it. Scholars just leave it. But the word really means a deep inner spiritual anguish. So he goes in, he's starting to study, he's working his way into understanding the person that he needs to be, but he's living within a system, a cultural system, that suggests that the way that you're the best friar, the way that you're the best monk, the way that you're the best person, is by doing things. Right? And Luther tells a fascinating story. This also has to do with a thunderstorm. Now, the theme of this week has to do with our concern about nature and social justice with nature. I'm really struck by how much, many times, Luther makes decisions based on something that happens to him while he's out in nature. It may be a lightning storm, but that's okay. But Luther is out on another time. He went to the ordination of some of his students, and he's gone for a day, and he misses his prayers. And when he gets home that night, just as he's getting home on the horse, a great big thunderstorm breaks out. And again, Luther once again feels fears for his life. And Luther says that he decides that it must be because he skipped his hourly prayers. And so what he does is he goes back and he redoes all the prayers that he's skipped through the day, which means that he's going to pray through the night, and then the next day he's going to stay up all day and then pray through the next night. He prayed himself into a delirium. Remember that early thin picture I had of Luther, right? You know, he really has a very difficult conscience. He's living within a system that's saying, this is the way that you get right with God. And so suddenly he's got this spiritual crisis. He's confessing all of his sins to his confessor, who becomes his spiritual father, a guy by the name of Johann von Staupitz. And Luther calls him all the time, calls him my most beloved father in Christ. And Staupitz goes, you know, is listening to Luther. He's a spiritual guide. He's a spiritual director. He's a magnificent author in his own right, a very beautiful spiritual writer. Not many people read him. He's not translated into English much, but he's a very interesting guy if you get a chance to read him. And Luther goes to him and he says, he's confessing his sins, and there's a movie which has an accurate quote in it. Movies aren't always accurate, but there is an accurate quote in it where Staupitz says to Luther, when Luther comes to him for confession, Staupitz says to him, listen, you're confessing all the time. You're not even confessing anything remotely interesting, right? I wish you would do something that would be remotely interesting. You're just confessing that you missed this prayer and you skipped that. He says, and Luther's enemies, even his enemies, even his worst enemies, admitted that Luther was the what Luther said, these are a quote from Luther, I was the best monk at monkery that ever lived, right? You know, that he was really good. He did all the prayers, all the hours, all these sorts of things. But there was a deep inner emptiness within him at the same time, this unbeckoning. I wonder also now, as I work through this, if as we as human beings are working through our passions and conscience, if there isn't this deep inner anguish that we sometimes have. And the anguish seems to come out, in Luther's case, it's about the system. It's about the way he figures that he has to be right with God. He has to do these certain things. And he is really in terrible physical shape. And Staupitz finally says, okay, I think I have a solution for you. He's worked with Luther for a long time. He says, you need more education. Go off and get your doctoral degree. That doesn't sound like really good advice to me. I mean, doctoral degree? I mean, that was one of the worst periods of my life. Anybody doctoral degrees, you know, right? Tough times, right? Would you think that that's good spiritual advice? It worked in this case. How about you?
It certainly brought me to infectum.
there's certain anguish. I mean, there's something that's going on. Staupitz was really astute with Luther. He knew that he had to get Luther away from the practical, everyday sort of regular routine that was considered. So Luther goes off and he starts studying. This is a famous painting by Patton from 1861, showing Luther just with piles of books around him. And he eventually becomes a doctor, a young professor. And he looks a little happier suddenly, right? He doesn't look quite as gone. Follow the pictures of Luther in his life, and you'll see his spiritual affect. And notice that I had that skinny picture of Luther earlier as a monk. He was so gaunt that he looked like he was a skeleton. Now as a young professor, he's slowly starting to deal with his unfechtening, start to dealing with this deep inner passion that he has. And so Luther is studying scripture, and Staupitz one day says to him, Martin, you know, you're still really hard on yourself. I think you should go on pilgrimage. And pilgrimage, if you want to know more about it, read Paul's book, right? And talk to Paul, because Paul's done a lot of work on that. But Luther is sent to Rome in Staupitz's behalf. Staupitz becomes the general of the Augustinian order. I mean, he's the top dog in that religious community. And so he sends Luther on pilgrimage to Rome in order so that he can do two things. One, he needs to deliver some messages for Staupitz. But Staupitz forbids him to ride a horse. He lives in Germany. He has to walk to Rome. And he has to go over the Alps. It takes him 6 months.
Wow.
In the journey just to walk back and forth. And he stays at... But now notice that Staupitz wants him to do the pilgrimage. So what is it about pilgrimage? Well, Luther goes on pilgrimage, and when he gets to Rome, he decides that he's going to go pray for his own soul. He's going to pray for his grandparents who have died, his grandfather who died not too long ago. And so he's thinking about that, and he goes to the Scala Santa. Anybody been to Rome? So a number of you. If you went to St. John Lateran's, St. John Lateran's is the Pope's cathedral. St. Peter's Basilica is not a cathedral. It's not the Pope's seat. But this is the Pope's seat. Across the street are these steps, the Scala Santa. Did anybody go? And did you climb up them?
I did.
Yeah, you did. Okay, that's wonderful. Anybody else? Did you do Ken as well? The Scala Santa. In that day, there were a group of Dominican friars that were sitting at the bottom of the steps, and they would say, if you would like to buy an indulgence, and then you climb up these steps on your knees and say a Lord's Prayer on every step. When you get to the top, that indulgence will allow a certain spiritual favor. This is a huge topic. I'm going to talk about it in my next lecture. What is an indulgence? What does it do? But let's just right now say, it'll buy a spiritual favor. It'll help your grandfather get out of purgatory. Okay, so that's the goal. So Luther tells us the story that he's climbing these steps. He's got the indulgence in his hand. And like Kent and, what's your name?
Kyle.
And Kyle, they climbed up the steps. Did you kneel and pray as you went up, or did you just walk up them?
No, I kneeled.
You kneeled? How about you, Ken?
I just walked.
You just walked, okay. I've done both. And this is the spot today. This is actually taken from Rick Steves' website. And you can still go climb up these steps. Luther tells us that somewhere up, about halfway up the steps, he said a question came into mind. Now, this seems like an insignificantly significant event. It doesn't seem like there's anything out of the ordinary. He's gone on this pilgrimage. He's trying to get himself right with God. He's thinking about his own struggles and his passions and his conscience. And a niggling question comes into his mind while he's on the steps. And he calls it a niggling question. And I kind of like that. He says, a niggling question. And it was simply this question. Is it true? Would God set up a system by which I buy a piece of paper and I climb up on these steps and my grandfather gets out of purgatory? Does that make sense? It was that question. It started bothering him. And as he was climbing the steps, Luther slowly starts to come to wonder, what is the function of indulgences? And not only that, what is the function of this system that has been set up in the world around me? Is this really true? So now we've got, where have we come? We've come to an ordinary kid who gets a good education, who has a significant life-changing event, a lightning bolt, literally. But for others, it might be something else. But in any case, something happens, and then that person starts to have a new direction in life. They feel their passion emerging, either out of their interests or out of their talents. And then a niggling question comes in, and their conscience starts bothering them. And now they can no longer go back. And it is all tied to the question of how the world works and how you perceive the world and how a system of justice is established. Now, I can't go too much farther today because what I want to do in the next two lectures is I want to have a talk about what the 95 Theses are, why they became then Luther's next step. The next step for Luther was to do what was normal in his society, and that was in his situation. He was a professor, he was a scholar, he wrote a paper and wanted to see what would happen. He never thought anything. The 95 Theses, he never dreamed were important. When he wrote them, they were not important to him, in the sense that he thought anything would happen. So I'm really going to unpack that next time. I'm just going to tease you with that a little bit. And then things are going to get out of control. And Luther's going to wind up before the emperor. How does a friar wind up before the emperor? How does a person distracting people from reality get to this point? I love this quote by Lima Gbogi. Don't wait for Gandhi, don't wait for King, don't wait for Mandela. You are your own Mandela, you are your own Gandhi, you are your own King. There's something at some point in your life where the passion and your conscience say, I must do something. And most often, in Luther's case, that something was the most ordinary thing in the world, to write a little paper. And that starts it all. It's the match. It's the match for everything else. Europe will change because of that. In the year 2000, there was a study done amongst historians, and they asked the question, what is the greatest document of the last 2,000 years? And the number one answer was the Magna Carta. Makes sense. Number two was the 95 Theses. Amazing, right?
Yeah.
This document that he writes simply out of his passion and his conscience, which he doesn't think is going to do anything, becomes incredibly significant. How does that happen? That's the question I want to ask next time. And I'm basically asking, what's that road to Reformation? And I use this kind of picture, kind of like this Holden-esque picture, because I think the thing about Holden, and I think the thing about nature, is that it has also this ability to awaken something in us, right? That when you come and get out of the ordinary structures of the society of the world that you're in, something can awaken. Something, you can start to see your own world in a new way. You can have a niggling question start bothering you. Is this true? Does this have to be this way? And if it doesn't, then the next question is, how do I get to the next step? And that's my next two lectures. But I'm going to leave a few minutes because I know Terry's setting up for, he'll be in here at 4. I'm just so amazed that we have such an incredible list of people, Elizabeth's reading tonight, and I just am very excited about all the people, and I can't believe you all came to listen to me because there's so many other good people to listen to, but let's take a few minutes, take like about 5-10 minutes at the most, so we'll leave some time for Terry to get set up. If you have any questions, does this make any sense so far? Does it help us think a little bit about some of
the question about, you were talking about your background in history, there was also the Inquisition going on at this time.
Yeah, exactly.
And world exploration.
Yeah, exactly.
So weren't there other things going on in the world also that people were expanding out, thinking about other things?
Oh, they were, and I'm going to get to that in the third lecture in particular. But the biggest issue that I want to come back to is that I don't want to say that Luther doesn't have any faults. And in 1492, Luther was 9 years old. And in 1492...
we sailed the ocean blue.
And all the Jews were expelled from Spain. And where did they go? And they went mostly into Prussian lands. They were forcibly converted, or if they wanted to keep their land, they forcibly converted, or they went into lands in the Holy Roman Empire. And Luther got to know them. Now, what's fascinating to me is early on, Luther, because he wants to become an Old Testament scholar, doesn't know how to read Hebrew, and he has to go and study with rabbis. And he goes and works with, and early on, he has this interesting sort of interfaith connection. But we know later on that this is going to be a real problem for Luther. So that's a big problem. The Inquisition is going on. Luther has no clue that when the 95 Theses are written, how close, how near death he will get. And we'll talk about that because, you know, there will be a very, very real threat. And that's, I think, a part of what I'm going to want to try to get at. If you follow your passions, I think there's going to be a real threat to you as a person. It might be your reputation. It might be other things. As Martin Luther King Jr. found out, it was much more serious than that. People who really follow their passions take them to great ends and often wind up, unfortunately, dead, right, with great risk. But
I don't know how important this is, but at the Wartburg right now, the display for the 500th anniversary really questions whether or not there ever was a posting of the 95 Theses reflecting German scholarship.
I'm going to bring that up because I'll bring it up next time. We'll talk more about it because the first time we hear of the 95 Theses being posted is from Melanchthon after Luther has died. And Melanchthon wasn't in Wittenberg at the time. So that's why there's some... I'll go into more detail on how that, whether it happened or not, and I won't probably answer it to everybody's satisfaction, but I will go into the scholarly debate on that a little bit. So if you want to know more about that, I'll talk
about that. Is that the teaser for next time?
That's a teaser for next time. I hope you want to know more about that. Yeah.
In 1999, as I remember, Time magazine said that Luther was the man of the year. He was the man or the person of the millennium. And as I remember, the reason in effect was that he was the first modern man in the sense that he spoke out as an individual whose voice was by itself important rather than just being part of the empire or whatever. And I always sense that popularly, in popular terms, that probably was true, but it didn't really touch on the religious views or the Reformation as the religious upheaval it was.
Yeah, that's the third lecture, so thank you for setting that one up. That's going to be the lecture on the Diet of Worms. And it is an interesting problem. It depends. I'm a medievalist, and the reason I became a medievalist is because I was interested in studying Luther, but I was also interested in studying mysticism, ancient Christian mysticism, and the mystics. And I was convinced that Luther was influenced by the early mystics, and so I was trying to make that connection, but I couldn't really just be a Reformation scholar. I had to become a medievalist. I needed those tools that medievalists have in order to read Luther. And what's interesting to me is that a lot of the best Luther scholars today are medievalists, and they're reading him from a medieval lens as opposed to a modern lens. And they're trying to correct some of the things that we see as seeing, and you know, Luther somehow becoming the first modern man, which is lifted up sometimes. It's more complicated, you're right. I think you're absolutely right. It's not so simple. There's certainly something that happens at Worms that's iconic and is important, but what did Luther think he was doing and what was going on? That's another question. But there's certainly a shift, right? When Luther stands up, other people feel like they can stand up. It's like a catalyst for other things. And I think that's one of the big overarching things that I think is really important when you're thinking about developing conscience, that when certain people stand on conscience, then other people feel like they can too. And you can think of any movement that's been significant and important that stood on conscience, and it's always been able to win over others simply because they said, is this true? Is this the way we have to live? Martin Luther King Jr., right? You know, is this true? No. We have other ways. We can do better than this. You know? There's always one step forward, two step back, but it's a real struggle when you challenge the conventions of a society, because the conventions of a society, I think, is very amorphous. It changes very easily. I think that we see it in our society today, right? I mean, it's a very challenging time that we live in. My mom, who lived through Nazi Germany, says she hasn't seen anything like this. You know, this is, for her, very frightening.
There was a quote you had, Eleanor Roosevelt, and I didn't manage to jot it down. Do you mind talking back to Schweiger so I can cover it for now? Thank you.
Be happy to. Yeah, one last question. Yeah.
You mentioned that niggling was Luther's own word. I'm just curious what the German was.
I can't remember it right offhand. German, he loved, Luther is fabulous in German. He has great words he talks about his prayers as a monk later on as Flettergebets. Fluttering prayers, so like the beating of birds' wings and things like that. And it's, so he makes up his own words, and I can't remember which one the word you can look at. I'll look it up. It's a great question. Other questions offhand? Thank you very much. We'll see you later.